Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 127, I chat with Jeff Morrison, Tom Norton, and Chris Heininen about all the cool home theater goodies we saw at the Cedia Expo. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded September 10th, 2012. Episode 127, Cedia 2012. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek. This week, I've got three guest geeks, all of whom just came back from the Cedia trade show to give us their impressions of the Geek Fest that was in Indianapolis. First, we have Jeff Morrison, a freelance writer, the author of the novel Undersea, and a world-renowned hair model. Hey, Jeff, thanks for being here.
Hey, how's it going, Scott?
It's going great, thanks. As you can see, the hair model part isn't really true, but the other parts are. Next, we have Tom Norton, the senior editor at HomeTheater.com, and a returning guest. Hey, Tom.
How you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
Fine.
And finally, we have a new guest for this particular type of show. Chris Heininen is the senior editor at Secrets of Home Theater and High Fidelity. Hey, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Scott.
You betcha. Now, I'm watching the chat room, so those of you who are logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv, where you can get to as you're watching the live stream at live.twit.tv, can post questions for any or all of us, and we'll be sure to pass along as many as I can. So let's start with the email that we all got today from Cedia, which stands for the Custom Electronics Design and Installation Association, and which is the name of the organization, also the name of the trade show that we just went to. Which claimed that the attendance by non-exhibitors was up 4% from last year. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but I sure felt like the aisles were a lot less crowded than last year and in years past. What was your impression?
I'd say the same thing.
I felt the same way.
Very good. All at once. Let's start with Jeff.
No, it sure seemed like there was a lot less people. But at the same time, the aisles were also a lot bigger. So it might be slightly deceptive of how many people were there visually.
It's true. Now, Tom, you were mentioning to me earlier that with the booths being smaller, and I think we can all agree that they sure looked smaller, that the aisles were bigger and therefore it looked less crowded, which, as Jeff said, may have been deceptive.
Yeah, that's very true. I would say that about 90% of the booths were smaller than I've seen in the past.
Except for Crestron.
Well, Crestron, yeah, they own the show.
Man, that was a football field. Chris, what was your impression? Did it feel to you like attendance was down?
It seemed to me like attendance was down. The one thing I noticed this year is I got far more emails from companies offering free tickets and free invites to the show by replying back to them than I have in previous years. So maybe that led to more people coming to the show, though not necessarily paying to come to the show.
Right. Now, the Cedia press release was very clear that the numbers for non-exhibitor attendees were up, but they didn't say anything about exhibitor attendees. And my impression was that there were fewer exhibitors there. LG wasn't there, at least not in a booth. Samsung wasn't there. They usually are. And there was a lot more booth sharing as well, I thought. A lot of people were sort of doubling up in booth space. So overall, it was perhaps a bit of an indication of the economic hard times.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you said LG, Samsung, Panasonic wasn't there either. But
right.
Sony was actually the only manufacturer of flat panels that had a fairly major presence.
Yeah, exactly right.
Well, the only other high-end flat panels that were there were Sharp was showing their Elites in the Pioneer booth, just like last year, and there's no change. It's the same sets, but they were the only other major flat panel manufacturer that was showing anything.
Anything at all, right. And they were in the Pioneer booth as they were last year, and they weren't new.
No.
Now, before we get to the new flat panels, which there is some big news there, I just wanted to quickly mention something that I think none of the rest of you actually went to. The Sony had their press conference Wednesday evening at 5 o'clock. And of course, I've always gone to that. You guys have always gone to that. I decided to bail on it this year and go to the keynote address, which I normally wouldn't bother with. But this year it was Michio Kaku, the very famous physicist, talking about the future home, the future of the integrated connected home. And I found it fascinating. He was talking about how computer chips are going to be cheaper and cheaper, according to Moore's law, such that in 5-10 years, computer chips are going to be down in the range of a penny. And so they will become ubiquitous. He talked about economic and developmental cycles of the steam engine and the Industrial Revolution being followed by a crash in, say, I think it was 1840 or so. And then the next one was the economic crash of electricity was the next big development, and the economic crash of 1929. And then we had electronics now and the crash of 2008. So the next crash, he predicts, will be 2090 or so. And the developmental cycle that will precede it is nanotechnology and biotechnology, which we're starting to see now. And he had many, many fascinating comments. And I just wanted to just touch on that briefly. There's even a photo that I took of him. I don't know if John has put it up there yet, but he was a very interesting speaker. And I was very glad to have a chance to hear what he had to say. And I actually got to meet him, and he signed a book that that he wrote from me. So that was very cool. Anyway, that enough of that. Let's get on to the actual products that we saw. And as I mentioned, one of the pieces of big news there was 4K flat panels. Sony had probably the most prominent one at the show, and we do have a photo of that we can show you. The Sony, I've forgotten the model number now. It's the XBR84X900 in Sony's inimitable as style of naming products as everybody does. It was 4K, more specifically quad HD, 3840 by 2160. So what did you guys think of it? Chris, what was your impression of that Sony 4K flat panel?
I thought up close it looked really nice. I didn't think the black levels were spectacular, but that's also possibly the room or that they're using edge lit instead of a rear LED array. But I just don't know where we're going to find content for a while. To me, 4K seems more like an incremental thing that they can do with current manufacturing as opposed to a radical technology like OLED that we're going to see sooner as well.
You know, I've been getting a question about that in the chat room quite a bit of, what would you rather have, the 84-inch 4K flat panel or a 55-inch OLED at 2K, 1920 by 1080? Jeff, how would you answer that question?
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, I'm going to be doing an article about that in the next couple of weeks for CNET. But that's I would take OLED hands down. I don't see the need for 4K in most TV sizes. In big screen stuff like projectors and things, yeah, absolutely. It's amazing. But I think even at 84 inches, I think you're at the limit of what the human eye can see at the distance that most people sit from their TVs. You know, if you want to move closer, that's great. And even Sony, they did a backroom demo thing that I think a few of us went to. And they were saying, oh, we'd like you to sit 1.5 picture heights away from the TV, which is about 6 feet. Well, I don't think most people are going to sit 6 feet from an 84-inch TV. So the further you get back, the less that increase in resolution becomes really necessary. So I like Chris, I was impressed when you were up close and the detail is incredible. But when it comes down to it, it's still an edge lit LCD. So resolution is really the only thing this thing has going for it. And, you know, I know that the content will happen eventually, but for right now, I'm not that impressed.
Yes, and you're certainly right that the content for me is the big issue, because there isn't any commercial content for
now,
it. And
remember
that
we were in the same place. Yeah, we were in the same place 10, 12 years ago, though, that we were having these, you know, full HD sets or at least 1080i TVs, and we had barely no actual HD content. I mean, it was years before we had Blu-ray, and we certainly had much higher resolution than we had Source. So I'm actually, I think that's the least concerning part for the 4K stuff. I mean, I think the content's almost inevitable, but for right now, I'd much rather have OLED and the higher contrast ratio.
Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say I would agree with all that. I'd also say that for we may get a chance to look at one of these 4K flat panel sets. I hope we do in the foreseeable future. But not having seen it, you know, close up other than at a show, I mean, the comment was made, Chris made a comment about black level. I didn't see it under any circumstances at the show where I could really judge the black level very well. But I would say that for $25,000, I kind of would have liked to have seen full backlit local dimming on the set.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely. In fact, we saw it. Believe it or not, there were four companies showing an 84-inch 4K LED edge lit flat panel. That was Sony, LG, JVC, and Runco. And Sony's is quoting $25,000 available November. LG is quoting $20,000 available next month. And JVC and Runco were farther out. They were, quote, technology.
Were you at the LG event offsite?
I was.
Yep. I think our fellow journalist David Birch Jones, I thought, asked an excellent question, because he was curious, as we all are, of who's actually making this glass, because it's all the same. The specs are the same for all of them. So he asked LG, he's like, well, who's making this? And they were adamant that they will not talk about who makes panels or who sells panels, but that they were making that panel, which I just thought was a very clever response.
Yes, Go ahead, Tom.
Everyone was speculating that Sony's using the LG panel, which may very well be true. Sony doesn't really make... they don't fabricate panels for their TVs. They buy them elsewhere and make the electronics for them. Because they could argue that they do the electronics, therefore, you know, that's 80% of what goes on there, but who knows?
Right. That is certainly Sony's argument, that the electronics are such a huge part. But I'd argue the opposite, that I think the glass has a much greater part of the picture quality than what the electronics are doing. But that's just me.
Now, did you guys notice, Chris, were you at the LG demo?
No, I did not go to the LG demo.
Okay, so Jeff and Tom were there, I know, and I was. And interestingly, while Sony was showing true 4K content that was custom made for that demo, I'm sure, LG was saying, well, there's no commercial 4K content, so we're just going to show you upconverted 1080p, which is mostly what you're going to be watching on these sets for a while. And I thought, okay, well, that's reasonable because it's true. But did you guys notice the scaling artifacts in some of those scenes?
Yeah. There were a lot of artifacts.
Yeah, that was like, I think that was a mistake on LG's part. You know, because I agree, and I like the idea of it, that's what most people be watching is true. But the way that it was set up, and maybe it was just the way they haven't fully tweaked it yet. I don't know, but it did not look good, and it was certainly to do with the scaling, and perhaps some of the settings too. I think we were all talking about the amount of edge enhancement that was there and stuff that we could, if we'd had access to the menu, we could have certainly neutralized, or hopefully could have neutralized, but we weren't given the opportunity.
Right.
And this is
Go ahead.
This is one issue I have with the 4K, is that with the Sony, for example, is the HDMI chipsets haven't caught up, so you can only accept a 24p or 30p signal with these. So you can't even hook up an external scaler to get a 4K at 60 frame signal on most of these. So they're going to be stuck once we get true 4K content at a speed faster than 24 or 30 frames a second.
Definitely. That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that, but you're exactly right. I don't think it's the chipsets as much as the HDMI spec doesn't have 1080p, or sorry, 4K 60 hertz, 60 frames per second. It's not, well, can't support it. It doesn't have enough both. Bandwidth.
Right. It's not in the spec, therefore the chips don't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So it's kind of a chicken and the egg. Yeah, I think the other problem, with Chris and I have actually talked about this quite a bit, where you know, the advancement to 4K or the move to 4K, there are other aspects of the video signal that we could change and make better that are far more interesting than just strictly the resolution. I mean, what about the, you know, bit depth or color accuracy or any other aspect of the picture that we would probably see even at lower resolutions? But these TVs won't be able to do that because these are, you know, pushing the envelope right now of what's possible.
Well, I think they probably figured out that 4K is an easier thing to promote than all this other stuff.
That's very true. Very true.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually had a guy tweet at me this morning and had brought up a really good point that, you know, one of the advantages of 4K is that most people, when they're looking and shopping for a TV in a store, are only standing a few feet away from their from the TV, 6 feet probably at the most. And at that distance, 4K next to a 1080p panel would look amazing. Yeah. So the store sales would probably do very, very well.
It's interesting. Joel Silver, the president of the Imaging Science Foundation, told me some time ago how he thought that the sharp 70-inch flat panels, LCD flat panels, would do much better in the stores than even the OLEDs once they come out, because the OLEDs are smaller and people are simply going to gravitate towards the larger screen size.
I bet to an extent he's right. As long as you aren't allowed to walk to either side of that TV, because those things go crap when you walk off axis.
Right, right. Well, in addition to the 4K flat panels, of which there were four at the show, there were a couple of 4K projectors, one of which was the Sony, which we've already seen. Tom, you've even reviewed it already, so that's nothing new. Chris, you mentioned that you had some information about the other one, which was from a company called Sim2, an Italian company. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Sim2, it looks more like it's a commercial Christie DLP that's been converted with custom Sim2 electronics to interface with it. For the home market, it was $158,000 before you even had a lens, and takes a 30-amp, 220-volt line to even run. Though the one good thing about having that custom Sim2 box is potentially that might be able to be replaced in the future with, if they get a 4K standard over HDMI that allows you to run at higher frame rates than, say, the Sony 4K that has all the electronics built into the box itself.
Yeah, but good point.
You can afford to buy the Sony six times before you bought the...
Yeah, the Sony's only $25,000.
Yeah, the Sim2 puts out 20,000 lumens or something. So, I mean, right, if you want to build that 150-seat theater in your colossal mansion, it's going to work a little better than the Sony. But, yes, it is very well taken that the Sony could be replaced many times.
Tom, what was your impression of the Sony, just to get that out there? You actually did the review.
Well, I liked it a lot. I wasn't particularly crazy about the 4K material that was sent to us for evaluation. There's only one or two really decent clips, so it's really hard to say. I've seen it look better at shows where they're using, you know, better and newer 4K. As this show, they had some 4K clips that were better than what we were provided.
Mm-hmm. The other 4K projector, and I call it pseudo 4K at the show, was a whole line from JVC. Last year, JVC introduced what they call E-Shift, which takes a 1920 by 1080 picture and shifts the pixels rapidly around so that you get an effective resolution of 3840 by 2160. This year was the introduction of the second generation of that technology. What did you guys think? Did it represent an improvement? Jeff, what'd you think?
I mean, it looked good. I reviewed the top of the line last year, and it certainly, like pretty much all the JVC projectors, looked fantastic. I didn't really see the benefit of the 4K. I compared it to a 1080p DLP from a couple years ago, and the DLP actually looked sharper with most material. I think that was based on, you know, DLP just tends to look sharper than LCOS. Mm-hmm. But they're using a different technology this year. It's not the same. I believe last year's was liquid crystal, and this year is something else that's shifting these pixels. So I'm going to be very curious to see if it actually has a better benefit.
Well, yeah, apparently one of the problems people have reported, some folks from our side on our publication have mentioned, is that apparently the last year, JVC's cheapest projector was brighter than their more expensive E-Shift projectors. But some of the changes they made this year may improve that situation. They've made some changes, as Jeff just said, in the optical path that they claim increases the brightness considerably. I would say last year I was a little disappointed with the E-Shift technology. I found a way to turn it off, and I found that the projector looked better without it for me.
Okay.
But they've also made some changes in the E-Shift. They call it E-Shift 2 now, and they've increased the number of pixels they sample to do their processing and whatnot. So they claim it's better. And I will say that the picture in JVC's closed booth at the show was probably the best picture I saw at the show. Now, they had some specially produced program material for it, which may have helped a lot. But as you mentioned earlier, Scott, when you said it increases the effective resolution to 38-something by four times HD, it doesn't actually increase resolution at all. When you upconvert, you can't increase resolution, but it does make the pixels smaller, theoretically making a smoother image.
You know, that's a very good point, and I want to also make sure we understand that these JVC projectors cannot accept a 4K signal.
No, they can't.
Right. Even the current new generation, I want to say, they can only accept 1080p, and then they upconvert it, as you point out, and rightly so.
Yeah.
Chris, have you had? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was just saying, and the chip, the resolution of the chip inside the projector is still 1920 by 1080.
Right. Exactly right. Chris, have you had any direct experience with the JVC E-Shift?
I had both the X30, the entry model, and then the X70 last year. And when I got right up next to the screen, I could see, no visible pixel structure or anything else, but I couldn't get a bright enough image, to have a big enough image to see that from an actual seated position. The main thing I liked with E-Shift was the ability to do more alignment with the pixels. So with the 3 chip, you'd get a sharper image than you might with the X30, though it's not as sharp as the DLP, but it still would be sharper than a 3 chip without the extra alignment that E-Shift offered, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One new development at the show this year was JVC announced a new model with E-Shift at the $5,000 price point, and they were big on saying 4K for 5K, which they hadn't had before. I think the cheapest one with E-Shift last year was like $8,000, so they did bring it down. And so, and JVC projectors generally look very good. But whether or not the E-Shift is really worth the money, well, they brought it down in price. So hard to say.
Yeah, what other projectors?
Sorry, go ahead.
I was saying taking the X30 from last year and then adding on the color management system and the better alignment that new model is going to offer, I think it's the X55. That seems like a much better upgrade option than paying the $5,000 almost it was last year to move up a model.
Ah, very good. What other projectors did you see at the show that either impressed you or didn't? Jeff, how about you?
Well, actually, I just want to agree with Chris that the X30 last year was an incredible value. I mean, it had better contrast ratio than the top of the line JVC that I reviewed. And I think Tom was right. I think it was also a little bit brighter. So, yeah, I mean, I would like to see a few refinements. It wasn't perfect. But given my money, I'd probably pick a JVC, an inexpensive JVC projector, over probably any other display type if I was going to actually buy one of myself.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the week before, I got a preview of the new Epson projectors, the 5020 and the 6020. They tend to be very, very bright, and the two new models are THX certified. So, well, the 6020 was last year. Now the 5020 or 6010 last year was. The 5010 was not. The 5020 this year is, and presumably the color accuracy will be better. It'll still be very bright, and I'm looking forward to that. That was actually the 5010 was one of my favorite projectors from last year.
Hmm. I saw the 6020 demo at Cedia in their booth, and I thought the 2D looked pretty good, but the 3D I did not think looked very good. It had a lot of breakup of the image. It was pretty dim. That's what I thought anyway. Did you think it looked good?
Well, when I saw it, I actually went down to Epson down in Long Beach and to see, and they showed me both the 6020 and the 5020. And they actually had a new technology that they were pushing for this year that actually increased the brightness for 3D, and it seemed to work. I noticed very little light loss through the glasses. Now, that was at Epson, so I'm not going to say that that's definitely the case. I'll have to wait until I get one into the lab. But just as far as a quick look went, I thought it looked pretty good. I didn't think it was dim at all. And in fact, I measured close to 50 foot Lamberts out of the 5010, so I can't imagine it being dim in any stretch of the imagination.
Wow. Well, I do know that they changed their glasses from IR sync to RF sync, so you don't have to actually be looking at the screen for the sync to happen. I think we do have a photo now of the JVC projectors. Before we leave projectors altogether, I wanted to just show everybody. Oh, it broke again. Sorry. Never mind. Tom, what did you see in projectors that you liked?
Well, the ones that have already been mentioned are the JVCs, obviously, and the Sony had a new VPL HW50. I liked their HW30 last year. Unfortunately, they weren't. You're looking at the JVCs.
Okay, now, those of us who are looking at the video just saw the JVC projectors, which were lined up all very nice. All these pictures I did take at the show, by the way. So there are five of them. There are actually four new models. This was taken in the JVC Pro room. JVC's got a weird thing going on with models. They've got a consumer version and they've got a pro version, and the model numbers are totally different. So it's like, what's going on with that? Anyway, those and the pro version actually has the DLA RS48 and DLA RS4810, which are essentially identical, except for maybe the distribution channels. So it's like...
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on there? I'm sorry. So, Tom, you were telling us about projectors. Sorry.
Well, I mentioned the JVCs have already been mentioned, and they probably impressed me as much as any. I still like couple of the demos of the Sony VW1000 that we talked about earlier. But again, that's not a new projector, 4K. Sony also has, as I said, a VPL HW50, and I was quite impressed by their HW30 last year for $3,500. The 50's gone up to $4,000, but for that, they give you two pair of glasses plus a spare lamp, which, as we all know, that's together that probably adds up to $500 retail. So
sure, that's important.
Digital Projection had showing the D-Vision scope, which we've seen before from Projection Design. It's basically a projector designed to do 2.35 without using an anamorphic lens and give you full resolution. They do it by using a larger chip, and then they process it to fill that chip.
And did it look good? I didn't see that one.
It should, because it's $35,000. So.
Yeah. I did see the D-Vision LED, which we have a photo of, gives you, it's an illumination source is LED rather than a regular lamp, which means it has like a 70,000 hour lifespan without having to change the lamp. And they increased the light output to 1100 ANSI lumens, which is up from their previous LED, the M-Vision LED, which was only 650. So that's the big problem with LEDs. They're great for longevity, but they don't. They're not very bright compared to UHP lamp.
I reviewed the SIM2 M150, which is their LED projector. I reviewed it for residential systems, and you know, it was one of the best projectors I'd ever seen. I mean, it was bright enough. I think I measured 19 foot Lamberts on my screen, which was, you know, fine. But there is something different about the color created by an LED projector or an LED light source in a projector than with UHP. And it's hard to nail down, but it looks very different. It looks much more realistic. Even if the color points measure the same, the image just looks more realistic.
I have to agree with you. The LEDs that I've done have really looked great, and I've really enjoyed them quite a bit. Chris, have you done any LEDs?
No, the SIM2 that Jeff mentioned, I'm hoping to get a look at, because they were showing that again in their room. and that looked fantastic. Oh, actually, I did do Runeco's new, their LS100. It's a little short throw one they showed last year that goes right up against the wall.
Right.
You remember?
Is that LED? LED?
Yes, that's LED light source. And that looked the same way, where it's a different wavelength of light you're getting, even if it's the same X, Y, Y coordinates you see on like a CIE diagram. And so it seems like in Casino Royale, when they land on that blue water in the Bahamas, just have this really rich aqua blue you can't seem to get from a different light source than LED.
Yeah,
I had one an engineer at a TV manufacturer who we all know, but I'll let him remain nameless for the moment. But when asking him, like, why, when the measurements say that all the color points are the same, why do LEDs just look that much better? And his way of describing it is that it's painting with pure paint.
That's a good point. Somebody in the chat room is asking, Undermind is asking in the chat room, what about laser illumination? We didn't see any of that at Cedia. I did see that at the NAB show last April with Red Cinema, which is famous for making digital cinema cameras. They introduced a laser illuminated 4K projector, which I'm looking forward to tremendously. Unfortunately, the demo that they played there didn't look very good. And I don't think it was necessarily the projector's fault. I think it was more of the content that simply didn't look very good.
Yeah, I've been keeping an eye on that myself, because it seems like it would be a really interesting idea. The benefits of using LED is kind of similar for using laser. It's kind of very similar technology. And it's the same thing. It is, you'd have very specific wavelengths of light being created by the lasers, just like you would with LED. So,
very pure colors. Now, even purer with laser than with LED, but I get your point exactly. Tom, you had something to say?
I think it's important to point out on lasers, I believe, stop me if I'm wrong, because you have experience with the Red, at least having seen it and I don't. The lasers are used to illuminate something like a DLP chip. They don't shine directly on the screen with the lasers.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Correct. Yeah.
There are technologies, though. They haven't really come anywhere, but there were some prototype models of a scanning laser. I can't remember the name of it now, but there was a scanning laser technology. I don't think anything's come of that.
Yeah, I forgot.
Yeah, there were a couple. There were two LED laser hybrid projectors that were shown at the IFA show in Berlin. Actually, one was from Acer that I was reading a review of quickly this morning and couldn't finish. And then ViewSonic has one that's coming that's about $5,000 or so. So I haven't seen any numbers on that or how it performs, but kind of interested to see how that would actually look.
We know that
Casio actually makes, in one of their inexpensive projectors, like $1,000 or in that range. I reviewed it for the Sound and Vision website. They actually use a blue laser and a red LED and a green phosphor. I think is how it works. So the blue laser is kind of creating blue light, and then it's bouncing off this green phosphor to create green light, and then this red LED or something, like some variation on that.
And I tried to get more information out of them.
Yeah, it's very weird. And I tried to get more information out of them, like why they went that route, and they had no interest in telling me how it worked.
Am I not mistaken? That's also like a business or a presentation projector. It's not even a home theater projector.
It is, yeah. I mean, it was not really a home projector, and the colors really weren't great. But it was bright. It was tiny. I mean, I could see advantages to using that light engine. But at the moment, yeah, it's Casio. I don't think they're really that interested in going too far into the home market.
Right. Well, listen, we've talked a lot about video. The next step is, of course, to talk about audio. But before we do, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. Of course, Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to your home on just about any device you have. The TV itself has most TVs have apps, Blu-ray players, game consoles, smartphones, computers, of course. Anything that you have in your home that has a chip in it, as Leo likes to say, probably has a Netflix app, and you can stream these many TV episodes and movies to your home, as many as you want, in fact, for one low flat subscription fee. You can even start on one device and finish on another, offering you the ultimate inconvenience. Now, for Twit listeners, we have a special offer, a 30-day free trial. For those few of you who might not have tried Netflix yet, I do encourage you to do so. All you have to do is go to netflix.com /twit and sign up for a 30-day free trial. And I'll bet you have more than one device in your home right now that'll do it. So don't forget to use that URL, netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. So, Jeff Morrison, Chris Heinonen, Tom Norton, let's turn to audio. I think probably one of the biggest stories at the CEDIA trade show was soundbars. Would you not agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. It seemed like a soundbar show. I think I saw more soundbars than I saw in-wall speakers.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think you're right.
Exactly right. Did any of them really knock your socks off? Jeff, let's start with you.
The Definitive Technology one, I thought was really impressive. I mean, it's expensive. It's about $2,000, but they put a lot of, engineering into it and a lot of, lots of amps and, really cool subwoofer design. It seems like it's going to sound really good. When they did the demo, it sounded really good. I think I'm actually going to get one of those in for review. The Golden Ear soundbar also sounded really good. That's a passive soundbar. And they use that folded ribbon tweeter, which seemingly always sounds good. And for a soundbar, it actually, I was quite impressed by that one too.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you think?
I'm going to agree with Jeff on lots of those. I thought the Definitive one was very nice. The movie demo didn't work when I saw it, just the music. But it also was one of the few active soundbars there that actually could do like true HD and DTS master audio decoding internally, had HDMI switching, a wireless subwoofer. And so it was a little expensive at $2,000, but it also had a lot more built into it than some of the other models. Though I didn't see it, some people saw a Yamaha one that had a directional control where you could, say, move the sound over to you if you're watching football and your wife is sitting there and doesn't care, which they said worked phenomenal. But that's also on the show floor where there's no walls or anything else to cause reflections and bounce that sound back to the person that doesn't want to hear it.
Which are definitely important for that. Yeah, exactly. Tom, what about you? What soundbars impressed you?
I agree with the two or three that mentioned already. Atlantic Technology has a soundbar. They showed it a year ago, and they finally are shipping it within the next month. The price has crept up to $900, but it sounded very good. It's basically, unlike some of these others, it's configured for two-channel. But it uses processing that will allow you to get, with a pseudo surround, you can get with a soundbar, which is definitely a pseudo surround. But at any rate, you could make the argument that you really don't need three channels in a soundbar that's only 4 feet wide. But I still think you probably do. But the Atlantic sounded good. It's one disadvantage over some of the others is there seems to be a movement with soundbars to get them thinner, so when they sit on the wall TV, they don't stick out too much. The problem with that is, of course, one of the reasons that TV sound is so awful is because the TVs are so thin. So, it's a difficult thing to do. But the Atlantic is like six and a half inches deep, which could be an issue if you have an on-the-wall setup. But otherwise, you can mount it above or below the TV if it's on a stand.
Yeah, I was interested in the Golden Ear technology soundbar, which is, as you said, passive, doesn't have any amps in it. It's three-channel. So you have to basically feed it an amplifier signal, three channels worth into it. But Sandy Gross, the designer, who has been a guest on this show, actually, touted the fact that he had inter-aural crosstalk cancellation. So some of the drivers, the endmost drivers on the far ends of the soundbar, are used to cancel the left ear information that's getting to the right ear and vice versa. It seemed to work pretty well to me. I heard the demo and he didn't claim to do any simulated surround or anything. He put actual surround speakers back where they're supposed to be in the subwoofer and played the demo. And I thought it sounded very good. Another three channel soundbar, passive soundbar without any surround simulation was from PSB. It looked kind of similar, in fact, to the Golden Ear. I think we even have a picture of that, the PSB W3, it's called. And I thought that sounded pretty good as well. There it is. That's the soundbars on the bottom. And Paul Barton, the P&B of PSB, also on the sides of that TV have what he calls the W1, which is basically the center portion of the soundbar in a separate speaker so that you could have separate what are called LCR, left, center, right speakers, if you wanted, with the same sort of relatively thin form factor and so on. And in the booth, which was not the greatest environment to hear anything, I thought it it actually sounded pretty good. Did any of you guys get to hear the PSP?
Well, yeah, again, it was in an open booth, so it was really difficult to tell for sure.
Very difficult.
There's a cold in here. Atlantic and Finn have all had their closed sound rooms.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to make a comment, though, that the sound bars, as interesting as they are, and I can see you know the usefulness of them for a lot of installations, they still are not going to equal the sound you'll get from some small bookshelf speakers and a small AV receiver.
Jeff, what do you think? You agree?
Oh, I absolutely agree. Yeah, and especially with some of these expensive ones, it's kind of to me it's a very hard sell because you can get actually a full 5.1 speaker system and a receiver that does HDMI switching and everything else for under $1,000, and in some cases a lot under $100,000 or under $1,000. So under $100,000 too, I imagine. But
I would imagine.
You know, when these soundbars start creeping up over $1,000 or even, you know, over $500, to me, they become a tough sell. On the other hand, I understand that there's people who, you know, for whatever reason, can or don't want to have a 5.1 speaker system, and in which case, I guess these make a fair amount of sense. But yeah, Tom's absolutely right. A decent pair of bookshelves and even a two-channel receiver is going to sound incredible. And there are, I think all of us reviewed some pretty good powered bookshelf speakers that would work on their own as an addition to a television that sound pretty amazing, like Audio Engine and a few other companies. Paul Barton, again, actually PSB had a little computer audio speaker that was probably, it could fit in the palm of your hand, and it sounded incredible at the
show. It really
did.
I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly we know that soundbars are really intended to be something to get you beyond what the TV itself can do, but not at all really towards what a true 5.1 system can do. Chris, what do you think? Do you agree? I would assume you would.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, directly across from Definitive, you had Pioneer with their Andrew Jones designed, you know, affordable loudspeaker line.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's $130 for a, you know, tower that's going to sound far better than any soundbar is going to be able to put out just by physics. And so you can go buy a nice Pioneer receiver and a 5.1 or just a five-channel set of those for $1,000, and it's going to be phenomenal sounding. I mean, the soundbar is going to go towards, like, my wife or my dad or someone who wants to put this other system maybe, like, above a fireplace or in a living room or hanging off the kitchen and wants something better. But, I mean, for an actual theater room, that Pioneer system is going to blow away any soundbar I think we saw at the show.
I think I agree with what Chris just said, and I would say that my motto for the show is any self-respecting speaker manufacturer, though, has to have a soundbar or two and a set of headphones.
Yeah,
yes,
that's true.
Right. Apparently so.
And we did see a lot of headphones at the show as well. Paul Barton brought out the second generation of his M4U2, passive design without the noise canceling or amplification, but you could still, you know, use them with iPads and iPhones.
You know,
and
those sounded amazing, and the M4U2s were some of the best headphones that I've heard this past year. They're $400, but they sound incredible. They're very well reviewed, and the listening. I think he was calling the one without the noise canceling, the new ones, the M4-1s maybe?
M4-U-1, I think too. You're right.
Yeah, and those sounded amazing too, and they were even cheaper. So, and I think the reason why these speaker companies are doing that is that these are two hugely growing product categories, headphones and center soundbars. So they kind of have to survive. And for, you know, the past few years, these speaker companies have been struggling for many, many, many years, and now they're all of a sudden they have these two. They see growth for the first time, and that's exciting. So I certainly can't fault them for making soundbars, which we all scoff at, or headphones, which we shouldn't because they're great. But if there's profit in it and they're making more money, and then they can put that money into speakers that we might buy, I'm all for it. It's like Porsche making an SUV. Like, I wouldn't even touch that abomination, but that means that they can put that money into, you know, the Cayman or the Boxster Spider or something where it's like an amazing car. I'm all for it.
Good point. Yeah, very good point. Speaking of headphones, did any of you guys hear the Mosaics Blue Waves 7.1 headphones? Chris, did you hear those?
No, I saw everyone's entries about those as soon as I got back to the airport to fly home, but I did not see them myself, unfortunately.
Yeah, Tom, what did you hear them?
I heard them. They do sort of provide a 5.1 channel sensation. They struck me as I said in my blog, I said they need a little refinement. They didn't sound as good as some of the two-channel headphones that I heard.
Yeah, we do have a picture of that. I just want to show everybody. Here it is. In my window, it's zoomed in a little bit, but they're these big, giant headphones, and they've actually got 10 drivers combined in the two sides of the headphones. So they're these big, giant things. They provide you real surround sound with real, actual drivers and what they called vibratory subwoofers. And then underneath, when you buy this system, you also get this huge box that they're sitting on top of in this picture, which provides you the amplification for all the channels and a two-channel graphic EQ to, you know, be able to tailor the sound to what you want. Jeff, did you hear them?
No, I do have a question, though. I mean, are they also supplying a backpack for me to be able to walk around with these?
Well, you'd need one for that big giant box.
Yeah.
Now with the headphones and just the amps, they're $1,300. And if you want to add the graphic EQ into that big box, they're $1,600.
Honestly, that seems a lot, but there are plenty of headphones that cost that or more that don't have all of that, you know, fancy electronics with it. So,
yeah,
I reviewed a pair of headphones from JH Audio, these custom molded in-ears that are amazing, and they were $1,200 or $1,300 retail as well. And those are, you know, that big. So, yeah,
true enough. Well, I heard them. Tom, you heard them. Yep. It was an interesting idea. You did get a sense of surround sound, no question about that. But the sound was weird. The subwoofers, for example, sounded to me like they were rattling. It felt like something was loose inside these cans and it was rattling around. I don't think it's quite ready for prime time yet, but it sure was an interesting idea.
I would say they were very uncomfortable.
Yes, that too. They were on-ear, even more interesting. They weren't around the ear. Your whole outer ear did not fit inside them. It sort of sat on your ears, and It did get pretty uncomfortable after only a little bit of time.
Weird.
Wow. Yeah, that is kind of weird. Okay, well, we're kind of running out of time here, so I do want to ask you guys if there was anything else that you saw that particularly interested you, and I want to finish up with what you thought was the best audio and video you saw and heard at the show. Jeff, let's start with you.
Well, I didn't cover much audio, so I didn't really hear or see too much, although I guess, you know, that shortened thing in the PSB headphones certainly sounded great and the little bookshelves. But as far as video goes, we talked about it before, but that JVC projector looked amazing, and I can't wait to get in one of those. That'd probably be my pick. The Sony 4K TV, it looked amazing as long as you were sitting close enough to it to really get the resolution. But I think both are, you know, an exciting two different directions really. But I think they're both kind of exciting ways, you know, that we're about what the technologies we're going to be seeing for the future.
Mm-hmm. Tom, how about you? Did you see anything interesting, unusual?
Yeah. I would agree with Jeff on the JVC projectors that we saw. I would say on the audio side, probably the most dynamic. Somebody changed the headline on my blog and said I thought it was the very best sound at the show. No, but it was the best, most dynamic sound at the show, and close to the best was the Steinway Lingdorf demo.
Yes, I was going to mention that too. Go ahead.
Yeah, and for $500,000, you get what was it, 16 subwoofers, 16 drivers and their subwoofers and line arrays and. They played an excerpt from the movie Open Range, a gunfight that was, as I said in my blog, it was so loud after the first six gunshots, I put fingers in my ears, I'd forgotten my earplugs. So
yeah, we just saw a picture, by the way, of the Steinway Lingdorf that was introduced at the show. It's called the LS Concert. It's what's called a line array. It's got a big vertical line of mid-range drivers and some sort of electrostatic or planar or ribbon tweeters. I don't know exactly. You're right. The entire system was $500,000.
Yeah.
That's just the sound system. I mean, they were also playing it on a digital projection Titan projector. And that open range clip, what impressed me about that was the gunshots. You could hear the dialogue perfectly clearly. And the gunshots suffered from no dynamic compression at all. I mean, they were, it was very loud. I agree. I put my fingers in my ears too. But before I did, I noticed that the dynamic range was amazing.
Yeah, my only concern about that sort of using gunshots that realistic in home theater is if you have gunshots that realistic, say on a firing range, you're going to be wearing earmuffs and earplugs.
Right, you would be. That's right.
One other quick comment I'd like to make. There was an interesting new screen material from a company called Seymour Screen Excellence, a very small company. But they claim that it was not, it's neither woven nor perforated, but it does have some texture to it. It's a Well, actually, I have a sample of it here. You can see it visually.
sort of. Is it supposed to be acoustically transparent?
Transparent. See, now you hear it. Now you see. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good demo. Excellent.
That's right. I thought I'd throw that in. Okay.
Chris, you went to Seymour Screen Excellence, did you not?
I went to their booth, and they were the material being used for Priscilla Audio's demo. And yeah, before I think it's the Seymour Screen Excellence 4K, the Inlator is what it's called, I think. Yeah, it's the really fine texture. It's supposed to be very acoustically transparent and not have the real loss of gain or of potential larger holes that you can see if you're up close to the screen. And it looked fantastic in the demo, and I didn't hear any issues with it. But yeah, I'd like to get a sample of that like Tom has to see how it looks.
I'm not a big enthusiast of perforated screens in general because they do have issues with video losing light and perhaps other issues depending on the texture. So this has the least texture I've seen on most acoustically transparent screens. But Chris mentioned gain, but I actually think the gain of this was fairly low, probably definitely under one, maybe closer to 0.8 or 0.9.
I reviewed, I think it was a Seymour Screen Excellence. I don't remember what the model was now. It was for residential systems, I think about a year ago. And I found that it lost significantly more light than they were saying. And no screen is truly transparent. And certainly they claimed it was almost perfect, and it was definitely not that either.
You're talking acoustic transparency.
Right. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of perforated screens or woven screens or anything else. I think you lose too much for the small benefit of being able to put the speakers behind the screen, which is cool, but I don't know. I'm not impressed.
The problem is for someone that has a high-end installation that has a really big screen, you really need to have a transparent screen, which causes a problem. Of course, the bigger the screen, the more you lose because of the low gain of the transparent screen. But you can't, if you got a 15-foot wide screen, not many of us do, you don't want to have your speakers 15 feet apart.
No, you're absolutely right. And in those cases, those people can probably afford a projector that throws enough light that it doesn't really matter if the screen's absorbing it or letting it pass through.
Yeah. Right. Chris, what was your favorite demo at the show?
My favorite demo itself was probably the Pro Audio Technology one. And those speakers were also used at the Renco demo. They just seemed to be very dynamic. The bass was really tight. It was able to play incredibly loud without any hint of distortion, it seemed. And it was much more reasonably priced than that Steinway Lingdorf system was. they wouldn't let us. There's no retail prices. There's just dealer costs. So can't go on about that. But it was much more affordable than that one, for example. And the best demo that I liked was the JVC again, just because it's so reasonably priced and it's something great that we can all go out and pick up. Potentially. And one thing that I saw was the Oppo let us go see their new BDP 103 and 105 players.
I heard about that too.
Right. So everyone's loved those, obviously. And one big improvement on the 105 was the addition of USB optical and Toslink inputs. So you can take a media streamer or a PC, hook that up, and like with the Squeezebox Touch, suddenly use that nice Saber DAC to stream all of your music through it and get the full benefits of that without needing to go buy another DAC since you already have that one.
Right.
Cool.
And that's a great DAC as it is. So being able to access it with external devices, that is it's a big, big, big news. And I talked to Jason Liao of Oppo, who said that the 103 was going to be the same price as the current 93.
Yeah, the 103 was the same price, and it adds HDMI inputs on the front and back, the front of which is MHL compliance. You could hook up a Roku stick or your Android phone or something else to stream video and use the video processor in there to do correct color space decoding or image processing on that. The 105, they weren't sure about the price, though it also loses the fan. It's gotten a one rack unit higher, so it can have better ventilation and not need the fan, but give a date on when we're going to see those. But the 93 is now sold out from Oppo, so I can imagine the 103 won't be that far away.
No, I agree. I agree. Did anybody see the and hear the JBL synthesis system from Harman Luxury Audio? That was over at the Westin. I guess nobody
no,
did.
I
did.
Nah.
and it was also very, very impressive. Really good. We have a picture. I took a picture of the Mark Levinson amps being used to drive the fronts and the surrounds. There they are. Those are mega expensive too. I don't remember what it was. I wouldn't be surprised if that whole system was also in the $250,000 to $500,000 range.
Those floor standing amps that you see there that look like kind of like radiators.
Yeah, big, the number 53s.
53s, yeah. I think they're like 50,000 a pair or something like that.
Yeah, those are 50,000 a pair, and the floor units are the 533, which is
correct.
I think it's 10,000 a pair. I had that in recently, and that's a fantastic amp that drove my system to whatever level I wanted with no issue.
Yeah, yeah. No, that system looked great too with a Titan projector, but it really sounded phenomenal. So I'd have to say the Steinway Lingdorf and the JBL synthesis system were probably my favorite audio at the show. And I'd have to say the JVC was excellent as well, although those Titans that were in both Steinway Lingdorf and JBL synthesis looked mighty fine as well. So I think we've come to the end of a great discussion. I want to thank you both, all three of you, in fact, so much. Jeff Morrison, writer for a variety of websites and author of the sci-fi novel Undersea, which be sure to check out on Amazon. It's available as an ebook, and I think even as a paperback,
as well.
Isn't it?
Yep, yep. And, you know, Barnes & Noble or anywhere else, too. Yep.
Fantastic. And you're a fine hair model. I'm sure that you get plenty of work in that regard as well.
I do. It's really where I make all my money.
Yeah, that's right. And Tom Norton, of course, the senior editor at Home Theater and hometheater.com. Been there for many years and continuing to churn out tons of video reviews and some audio reviews, too. You've done plenty of speakers in your time.
Oh, yes.
So be sure to look for him there. And Chris Heinonen at Secrets of Home Theater and High Fidelity. That's hometheaterhifi.com. Chris, you do mostly video products, right?
I do mostly video, mostly lots of Blu-ray, projectors, displays, but I also do plenty of audio too, since I just enjoy it. So,
right. Well, you know, we're all very blessed to be able to look at all these new products and get them in and take them for a spin and write about them and see what's what. And being able to go to the CD show is certainly one of the great joys of my life. It's very tiring. I didn't put nearly as many miles on my shoes as I do at CES, but it's a more focused show on the kinds of things that we really like to talk about, which is projectors, flat panels, video, and audio for home theater, and kind of higher end too, for the most part. So thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
So next week is actually, next Monday is Rosh Hashanah. So I will be blowing the shofar. And so I'm going to pre-record the show for that day on Friday, the whatever that date is, the 14th, I think. And that'll be at 2:00 p.m. Pacific time. So I do hope you will tune in for that live. And it will also be played then on Monday, the 17th. And my guest at that point will be Barb Gonzalez, and we'll be talking about all the latest news in streaming media. She's been looking at the new Vizio streaming box and a couple others, and she's going to give us a report about that. So I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.